an interview with John Russell and Ferdinand Ruppland of the German department in their offices, Monday, May 16, 1918.
For the question number, because...
Yes, question number on there.
Should I start?
Go ahead.
Okay, question number one, Ferdinand A. Ruppland, Department of Germanic and Slavic Languages, Associate Professor.
John R. Russell, Associate Professor of German in the Department of Germanic and Slavic Languages.
You're German.
Good days. Not now.
Both of us have been chairman.
I see.
Both. Ferd was chairman 3 years. I was chairman at three different times for 9.5 years, I believe.
Who's chairman now?
Ed Stravinsky.
Stravinsky. Okay. All right.
Okay, with regard to question two, this is Ruppland speaking. I came to Stony Brook in 1963 at the age of 29.
Russell came in 65 at the age of 36.
What kind of a department existed at that time?
Well, in 63, it was a Department of Foreign Languages. Most of the faculty members were junior. And of the people who came, who were there in 63, only two of us are still here. Ruppland and Carol Blum in the Department of French and Italian.
In 65, the Department of Foreign Languages had just split into Romance languages and the Germanic and Slavic.
Hold it, let me see if I'm getting this now. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, shall we proceed to number four?
All right.
Okay, this is Ruppland speaking again. Professor Seymour Flaxman, who was chairman of the Department of Foreign Languages at that time, through a friend of his from Yale, Konstantin Reichardt, through his protege, Cecil Wood, who was my mentor, that was the connection between Flaxman and me. He gave me a call late one night.
At Yale? You were at Yale?
No, I was at the University of Minnesota, and I was an ABD as an instructor there. I'm anticipating the next question.
Okay, all right.
Russell, my Dr. Vater knew that I was looking for a job, and introduced me to Flaxman and interviewed me at the annual slave market, the MLA convention.
Okay, well, this is Ruppland again. The market at that time was very, very good, and I was not really looking for a job. I'd had several offers. But when Flaxman called me, I was flattered at the notion of coming east. That is part of question six. I guess I've anticipated that. I came out for my interview. It was for a Middle Western boy whose only experience outside of the Middle West had been in the service, which is parochial enough. I was very impressed, came out to the campus here, and I was interviewed, I think, by every department chairman, including the executive officer. Is that your title, Dr. Hudson?
Chief administrator.
The chief administrator. Now, that was very impressive. I guess just the idea that it was Eastern was what impressed me the most, influenced my decision to come out here.
Hey, John.
If we're on six, why did I come? I was looking to move. I had taught for 6 years previously at Wabash College in Indiana and left it due to an argument with my chairman who would interfere with my grading, and also because I thought it was time to move on, much as I enjoyed teaching at a small college.
Did you know Byron Trippett by any chance?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. After I left there in rather of a hurry and went to Centenary College in Shreveport, Louisiana, which again was a very pleasant teaching position, a small college where everyone knew everybody, but it was in the darkest south and not a very pleasant place to bring children up in my opinion. Why did I come to Stony Brook?
Yes.
I was interested in remaining in higher education, but I wished to go into public education where I thought the nation's interests should be put. Stony Brook, to anticipate further questions, had the reputation of a young, growing, dynamic institution dedicated to public teaching. It was also in a very nice part of the United States, as far as I was concerned, even though I'd never been on Long Island. I knew its reputation in terms of climate, its obvious geographical situation, etc. It seemed most attractive to me since I didn't think Harvard was going to call me.
Okay.
Of course, another reason why I came out here was it was time to come to jump out of the nest. The University of Minnesota wasn't going to keep me as an ABD instructor forever. And I was impressed by the fact that it was a brand new institution, and it was appealing to me to see what would happen in the creation of the university. As regards question 7, if that's cool to go on to that one, I didn't really understand the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook. I didn't understand the purposes behind the creation of any institution, and I'm not so sure that I do right now. I certainly am awed by what has happened in the 25 years since I've been here at Stony Brook. Certainly Stony Brook has not become what I thought it was going to become, or what I felt it might become, because I'm not so sure that I really thought about it.
Yes. What do you mean by what it has not become what you thought it was going to become?
Well, the image of Stony Brook that it was projecting for itself when I came, of course, was the small New England college type of thing, and I was impressed by this image, I guess primarily by the community. I lived in the community. I also was impressed by the attitude, which I had respected at the time, the rather elitist attitude of the faculty. I felt that the faculty was very much Ivy League, and I was a little bit awed by that. I came from a populist background, coming from a land-grant university, and I was a little troubled by that, and I suppose that would relate to subsequent questions about how I felt about what was happening in the 60s, the late 60s and the early 70s.
I've partially addressed this question already. The 2 years difference, I think, made quite a difference in that the New England College was no longer apparent at all, and the fairly elitist faculty-student ratio, which had existed, I think I looked up Stony Brook in the 63 Almanac, as a faculty of something like 120 and a student body of 800. By the time I got here in 65, I think we were over 2,000, and obviously going, we were not a New England college, nor headed in that direction.
Okay, well, if we want to get down to 8, the impressions pertaining to the campus itself, the people and the leadership, I guess I have to relate that to 9, because what I remember of the decade of the 60s was 1968, and almost everything that I think of when I think of the 60s is 1968, from the student demonstrations to the construction workers to the arguments in the faculty assembly about who should vote in the first place, and secondly, should we have professional programs, and all these kinds of things that were all new to me as a young person. I had been involved in the civil rights movement in the 50s, and I became somewhat involved in the anti-war movement on campus, but by that time, having a wife and 3 children, I was a little mellower than I had been in the 50s.
Being a veteran.
And being a veteran, I was, I did not run up to places where there allegedly were bombs planted. I ran away from places where there were bombs planted, whereas in the 50s I might run up to those places. 1968 is it. That's the big thing that stands out in my mind. And the people who were associated with these things, of course, then the drug busts and so forth. The residential college program, I was involved in that.
Were you?
Yes.
Okay. What was your function? Residential college.
I was master of Langmuir College.
Langmuir?
Yes.
I see.
I was there the day of the lottery, the first lottery. And the person who was drawn first won the grand prize in the dorm. I don't know what that was any longer, but it was a proud moment for that person. I don't know whether he went. 285 or so students in the dorm, but that impressed me as well.
What about are you on 8 now?
I guess I'm on 8. I've already given some of my impressions. I think I was less impressed by 68 than Ferd was, simply because I was impressed all along by an institution in evolution. And one of the things that most impressed me and continues to fascinate me was our getting into computer-assisted instruction. Already in, I think the first year I was here, 65, IBM approached the college, and Ferd started teaching in 66, and I got into it, I think, in late 64 or 67. And that to me was very exciting, pedagogically. And so, but it was simply symptomatic of the whole university, which was an evolution. And 68 was, somehow seemed a part of it. Not a terribly happy part of it, but a part of it. And leadership, again, Toll and I arrived at the same time. I found him a strong leader, not particularly a friend of the humanities, but still a very much part of a growing, evolving institution.
Ann and I lived for 6 months at Sunwood. Next door was John Toll, and I had occasion one time to go in and I saw some poetry on a table beside his bed. I think he had broader interests than he had a chance really to follow.
Oh, I not mean to suggest he was contemptuous for, in any sense.
No.
I mean, right, that he was very open.
Right.
But he had other interests.
Yeah. He thought he was going to do some research in physics. I think he discovered that administration took more time than he had expected.
Another thing that stands out from that time were the annual faculty parties, which when I came were still held in Sunwood. Soon moved the gym and were soon abandoned. It was simply changing that fast.
I was always impressed by the annual parties that were held out in Oyster Bay, hosted by the Hartzells. And I was always impressed by the fact that your wife knew everybody's name, including those of the children whom she hadn't met. And somehow that she was able to sort them out. That Ferd obviously was the oldest one because he was named after his father. And Warren was obviously the youngest one because that's the most recent name she learned. You know, tremendous talent. But here you have this kind of dichotomy. I had the image still yet from the Oyster Bay, although I wasn't there, and the New England thing smashing into the late 60s, and as John said, with CAI coming and so forth, of course, this was very flattering to a kid from the Middle West, too. I mean, people were coming up to us and saying, hey, we got the CAI program, how would you like to be the first people in the world to do this?
CAI.
Computer-assisted instruction.
Yeah.
And that's not the kind of thing that I had experienced before. Nor had I experienced editors coming out and asking us if we had manuscripts, if we would like to write books and so forth, which we did, John and I did. We did create during that period, I guess this is the evolution to which you were referring, John, is a very, very fancy foreign language program in which we had closed circuit television, computer assisted instruction, conventional audio language laboratory, plus programmed classroom text and lab manual and workbook, which of course has since been abandoned for lack of funding and support. That's a little twist from the 60s to the 80s.
Next.
Well, I guess that gets to 10 for me, the understanding of my place. I was hired as a philologist, and Seymour Flaxman, bless him, decided that I would be an applied linguist overnight because we needed somebody to supervise teacher training, and there was nobody close to it. I guess the departmental philologist came the closest because the departmental philologist had heard of a grammatical paradigm or something like that. And as a result, I haven't been a philologist now for 25 years, but I have been involved in a lot of teacher training kinds of things. John came out, I guess, let me speak for you if I may, John, for a second, as an expert in the works of Tumul and ended up as an applied linguist in order to fill the needs of just the everyday stuff of service courses and so on. So,
yeah, I don't think either from without or within things were so well defined in my mind as to any teleology of where I was going. We were simply had a lot of work to do and get on with it.
What can you say about the evolution of the department itself? Or toward graduate work, or toward literature courses, proliferation of literature courses.
in this period of up to 71?
Yeah, all right.
We hardly count there. Bentley Glass brought in a person named Andrew White, whom you may have known, probably did, who turned out to be somewhat of a disaster. He was should have been a salesman. He was a wonderful four-flusher, a great showman. This was the time when the administration was recruiting on the star system. And somehow he was perceived as a star. He ended up, after 3 years, when he was not reappointed, living in seclusion over in Gershwin, not having anything to do with the department, and so forth. But because of him, or despite of him, we did apply for graduate work. We were processed and allowed to start in 1970 with excellent reviews for possibilities, potentialities, etc. And so things moved smoothly on the whole.
When did additional staff come in beside you two?
Oh, we grew at least a person a year. At least a person a year on the German side. I think at our high point we had something like 13 or 14 people in German, or 13 and maybe 7 in Russian, plus some part-time instructors and so forth. 68 took care of part of this, of course, getting rid of the 2-year language requirement to no language requirement.
No language requirement now.
There is one now.
There is one
there
now.
Has one been reintroduced that is an exiting requirement of 1 year or the equivalent. And most of our incoming students can satisfy that requirement.
I guess we could sum that up by saying that I think there were 3 or 4 people in German when I arrived in 63, Sloan, O'Neill, and me. I think that was it. And we had, as you said, what, 12 or 14 by 1970 or 71, and now we have, depending upon how you count them, is the count 6?
6 Germans and 1 Scandinavist, if you want to include him as a German.
So we were building with the university in the 60s, but the priorities have changed. I'm kind of anticipating here, once again, 12 here, about the expectations working out.
Yeah.
And in the 60s, we had kept
great expectations.
Great expectations. In the 80s, we have none. I mean, I personally feel betrayed by the institution because I was asked to service the university in foreign languages, and then they were taken away. I was asked to bring computer-assisted instruction in, which I did, which wasn't, I don't feel was recognized. More people knew about our CAI program in Germany than knew about it on this campus, I would say, if we did an actual count, except for our students. We were asked to chair programs. We were asked to build departments, were asked to supervise teacher training.
Off campus, in other words, in other institutions.
But no, here on campus. We developed the whole foreign language teacher training program. I would say John and I were principally responsible for this until Tersey came, and then, of course, and you certainly are going to want to talk to him. And now all of that has become meaningless. I don't know, do you feel that way, John?
Pretty much. Not quite the same. Generally, yes.
Well, is that characteristic of what is going on nationwide, or is that a local shift in priorities?
Can I guess first?
You go right ahead.
Nationwide, definitely in the 70s.
I see.
But certainly there is, well, there isn't a local shift in the priorities. I don't think anyone has doubted the fact that Stony Brook is destined be a natural science institution, and I haven't been fooling myself in that regard either. But we're not playing the game anymore, and I think other institutions in this country are pretending at least, or at least working to some extent in our field. John, how do you feel?
Well, this gets us well beyond 71, of course.
Yeah. The question is, have his expectations worked out? So I think it's fair.
Expectations have not worked out. Having introduced graduate studies, for which we always received excellent reviews, our reward has been to take away the doctoral degree, to reduce the staff, to a point where, if I were an honest and candid outsider, I would question whether we can fulfill what we're supposed to be doing in offering our degrees, whether we are doing a competent job. and that's a degree of non-support which is incomprehensible in a honest university. Someone should make some decisions along the line as to do we or don't we, rather than let's dabble for improvisation.
Is this due primarily to an FTE point of view? In other words, no support if you don't have students majoring in the field?
I cannot read minds. This is the justification used.
Right.
Of course, in a more exotic language, the more impossible it is to defend any program, much less a doctoral program. My counter to this is, let's have a faculty to curriculum.
That's
FTE, a faculty to curriculum ratio. By our rules on campus, every major has essentially the same requirements.
Right.
Therefore, why does one department have 40 or 60 faculty members and another one have 11 to run 2-degree programs? It's irrational.
Our FTE was quite favorable before the language requirement was eliminated. Obviously, we were doing our service responsibility pretty well in those days. So our FTE is not favorable now, so our staffing is cut. And, you know, it's just a circular kind of thing. But I could count on teaching 3 courses every semester in the 60s. I signed off on 11 courses this year. That's 5.5 per semester, 3 each semester in the 60s.
You signed off on 11 courses. What does that mean?
Well, I had a graduate course, which was obligatory. There were only 2 students in the grad, but that's a course that I had to offer. And I had an undergraduate course that was obligatory. That's each semester. So we have 4 courses now. We make our money, of course, by teaching the language courses, elementary and intermediate. We all have to teach those. We have to staff these courses. And so once you fulfill the responsibilities of teacher training in my area, applied linguistics and historical linguistics, plus language teaching, we got 4 specialties already that are not seen by the outside as separate specialties.
Yeah.
And that's, I think,
don't generate FTEs.
And they don't generate FTEs. Every time I have to add another class, an obligatory graduate course with 2 students, it looks silly on the books. Why are you teaching that course in the first place? Well, we do have our obligations. So you can, I'm sure you can sense a little bit of bitterness on our part.
Yes, I can.
I'm not so much bitter as frustrated.
Yes.
Why is it as it is? And to whom do you speak to change things?
Yeah. Okay.
It's rather strange that, you know, in the 60s during, or despite all of that turmoil, and all that time in the faculty assembly when I was representing the dissidents and the populists and so forth and so on, I always felt support, nevertheless, even if my opinions were different from a lot of people.
Support from the administration?
Support from the administration, support from my colleagues, elitist or otherwise, you know. No matter what. I felt support from John Toll. Obviously, I was not on John Toll's side, but we always were able to speak and understand each other, and I always respected the fact that he let anybody say anything that he wanted. I don't have the feeling now that I can't say anything I want. I just don't want to say anything. That's, I guess, frustration is a closer word to it.
Or that it'll be heard if you say it.
Or that it will be heard, yeah.
Well, the provost is a marine scientist. You now have an associate provost who is comes from the field of art. On genetics, you have a dean who is a phenomenologist in the field of philosophy.
Yes. Indeed we do.
We do not feel that we are supported by our dean. We do know that we are supported by the vice provost for undergraduate studies.
Who has no monies, therefore, still on speaking to the Pope.
The Vice President for Undergraduate Studies now is...
Vice Provost, that would be...
Vice Provost.
Janitis.
Janitis.
And she likes us very, very much, because our students like us very, very much, and she's Vice Provost for Undergraduate Studies, and when things go smoothly in undergraduate studies, it's good for her, and we like her. But she has no power, really, as far as we're concerned. It would be the dean. And we do not feel that we are being supported by the dean.
Where do his interests lie?
In his own self, Humanities Institute, which robs resources without doing anything productive. It takes TAs away, we're badly needed. I think he has 8 TAs now. Humanities Institute might be a good idea if we had strong humanities departments. They're being pillaged. They're already weak and being pillaged to create an ego trip. And it's hard to see beyond that, including the director, they think, who seemed to be an intellectual heavyweight.
Okay.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But we're talking about now.
Yes, we're talking about now.
In the 60s.
Right. Well, back at the ranch.
Okay, well, question 13, activities confined to Stony Brook campus or outside. I personally didn't really have anything to do with anything that took place within the university system off of the Stony Brook campus.
We did have relations with IBM, and particularly FERD and so forth, but your question seemed to be SUNY.
Was interested in your relation to the discipline as it's organized nationally.
Mm-hmm. FERD did quite a bit, we think.
Yeah, well, I tried to get the university associated with the American Association of Teachers of German. There was no involvement at that time because we were very young, very junior. Most of us were not tenured. Most of us did not have our degrees. We did get involved with the Long Island American Association of Teachers of German. We did get very involved with the national chapter in the 60s and in the early 70s. Barbara was very involved then. We were very much involved with the New York State Association of Foreign Language Teachers. A lot of this involvement came because of our work with computer-assisted instruction. The profession was sort of impressed by the machinery in the 60s. And so we were invited, John and I were invited out to talk about our program in Chicago and Los Angeles. Here, I was very young. John was not quite as young, but pretty young. And from a Middle Western state too, so this once again impressed us. New Orleans, Boston, Atlanta. We did read papers, and we did make people know that we had something here in the 60s.
Did you have any dealings with the computer science people here on the campus? Jack Heller, for instance, or anything?
No, that's a peculiarity of the, Heller was new. We were here when he was interviewed, as a matter of fact. We went here at one of his talks, I think.
Heinemann?
This is the nature of the, this is the nature of the beast. What IBM was doing was really so simple. Human language is so difficult that what one can do, and even, this is even true today, no matter how much more sophisticated it is, you end up doing very simple things. And for our needs, we learned very quickly, or thought we learned very quickly, that the computer is a very effective tool for learning language deductively, which is what adults do, which is our business. But what we want to do is very simple, and it's hard to find anyone in computers who's interested in doing anything so simple.
I see.
They want to be on the cutting edge, understandably, and should be. They don't know foreign languages. They're typical American monoglots,
yes,
on the whole. If they're polyglots, then they're even less interested in working in foreign languages. They want to be on the sharpest point of that cutting edge and so forth. It's an anomaly. We knew they existed. Our big contact was Ed Lamb.
Oh, really, in physics?
Who was very impressive. Well, he was head of the ERC
for
7 or 8 years.
Right.
And he essentially recruited us.
ERC is Educational Resources
Center.
Right.
And he interpreted that to mean something other than an audiovisual lending facility, and had got interested in computing, gave courses in computing, tried to recruit people, what was their name in anthropology and nursing? Peg Wheeler.
Yeah, Peg Wheeler.
Yes. I think what Peg did and what we did were the most interesting experiences, which certainly came out this campus, and what we did was perhaps the most successful thing that was done in foreign languages, with the IBM experiments from 65 to 72 or so.
Speak up as loudly as you can, so we can copy it.
We have to remember that there was a lot of money floating around in those days.
Yes.
Not only on campus, but off campus. We certainly benefited from what IBM did. And we certainly benefited from the support we just got automatically on campus. Whenever we were asked to read a paper somewhere, it was supported. Whenever we wanted more for experimentation or whatever, it was supported. It was just for the asking, that's all. Of course, that certainly isn't the case now.
Okay.
It's hard to think of the 60s as being the glory days, because I'm sure that most of the people on this campus think of the 80s as being the glory days. But for us, the 60s were.
I see. All right. Anything else that crosses your mind? Or have we come to the end of the questions?
Well, we're pretty much at the end of the questions. By 71, I think John would agree with me. We felt that we had done a really good job in building a department. Because as John had mentioned before, we were about to get our PhD program. We had our CAI program going. We had an international reputation. John has been maybe too modest. He's still invited often to discuss the CAI program in, for example, East Germany, and you did discuss it in Poland, and I was invited in France. This is all because of what started in the 60s. John has been very much involved with it since then, and is recognized for doing so, but it started in the 60s.
Well, we weren't allowed to get a swelled head. One of the more amusing anecdotes I remember is I wrote a rather feisty, I forget what triggered it, but I wrote a rather feisty memo suggesting, one, there might be a Department of Modern Languages for the sake of intelligent language instruction, which was still one of my theses to get technological support, staff support, instead of atomizing things. And I, in this memo, I also dropped the phrase that if anybody wanted an intelligent discussion about language and language teaching, one had to go over to the ERC and talk to Malcolm Skolnick and Ed Lamb and so forth. And this caused the change to rattle a bit in the department. I guess we had three departments by then. Spanish had split off from French and Italian. And Bentley Glass called us in. I guess maybe Ferd signed it. Ferd was certainly along on this. And Bentley sort of looked at his watch and said, well, it's very interesting what you have to say there. You have anything more to say? And we talked for a few minutes. He said, well, thank you for coming, but I have something important to do now.
On the other hand, Bentley Glass was very supportive when Langmuir College was dedicated. And he gave some personal funds, as I recollect, to Langmuir College.
He's a good man.
And I remember when I was...
Give some personal what?
Funds.
Funds.
And I remember when I was college master, I had the privilege of having dinner. And this all was supported by the university and philanthropists like Bentley Glass on campus. I had dinner with Benjamin Spock. I had an opportunity to have dinner with our very own Nobel Prize winner here. Once again, this is the 60s. It's kind of funny. I still think of those as the glory days.
Of course. Well, that, those situations and those actions and those people are what create the traditions of an institution. And they in themselves are important, not simply on a horizontal time basis, but on a vertical time basis.
May I shoot out one other anecdote, as
sure.
Long as we're speaking anecdotally of the 60s.
Right.
This relates to my interviews when I came out here. At that time, chairman or acting chairman of Poli Sci was Martin Travis. And I'll never forget Martin Travis. He's become a very close friend of mine since, so I can speak about him anecdotally. I'll never forget him sitting behind his desk with his suit on, of course. I wore suits in those days, and white socks, which were unheard of to me, advising me not to leave the University of Minnesota until I had finished my dissertation, because he was sure I would never finish it if I came out here. And I've kidded Martin about that. But we were fairly close, Carl. I think you can remember that. And
he's a great chap. I think, I think a lot of it. It's the intellectual odyssey of people is a fascinating study. If you're a dean, you see all kinds of individuals, and you see minds that wander from one core of thinking to another, almost like a tornado, bouncing here and there. You hire somebody to do something, suddenly you find he's got off in here.
Perhaps because we were small, we were closer, that I felt more leadership.
I didn't see Reuben Welch's name on your list.
No.
When you interview him, you might remember that he taught German here, as well as being the librarian for several years.
Good.
Not just a historian.
That's a good suggestion.
He certainly is one of the memorable characters.
Right. Yes. All right. Well, thanks very much.
You're most welcome.
You're very welcome. And by the way, Carl, it's not all frustration. I felt really good yesterday at the announcement.
Now, this is my campus.
Yes.
And I wish Tom Kurtz were still standing at the door, because I would say, as loud as I possibly could, I built this campus brick by brick, Tom. That's what I like to tell the young
people. Would you like the...
Yes, I like
them. Both of them?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.